The headlines: Iran's foreign minister says the U.S. claims it is serious about reaching an agreement on the JCPOA, but still adheres to Trump's anti-Tehran policies. A new survey conducted by a Muslim group in Britain shows Islamophobic hate crimes are at the peak across the UK. And Ecuador says the country's oil production has fallen by 1.8 million barrels during 15 days of anti-government protests. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. The JCPOA revival talks have resumed, this time in the Qatari capital, Doha. Iran's foreign minister says an agreement will be within reach if Washington shows serious willingness to conclude a deal and act realistically. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said President Joe Biden has sent several messages to Iran saying he is serious in making a deal, but Tehran has so far seen no action. He said what Iran has seen is merely the continuation of an anti-Iran pressure campaign designed by the administration of former President Donald Trump. The Iranian minister said Tehran is ready to strike a firm and lasting agreement, and it will not cross its red lines. The JCPOA has been in a limbo since the U.S. withdrawal in 2018. Tehran says any agreement to revive the deal must lead to the full removal of anti-Iran sanctions. The Islamic Republic also wants guarantees that the United States will not quit the deal ever again. Tehran slams anti-Iran allegations made in the final communique of the G7 summit as baseless, one-sided, and unfair. Foreign Ministry spokesman said the communique shows the G7 leaders insist on failed policies that are the main cause of flaws in the implementation of the JCPOA. Also, the biggest factor preventing the creation of domestic security arrangements in the Persian Gulf region. Nasser Kanani said the communique is deliberately ignoring blatant violations of the JCPOA and a related UN Security Council resolution by the U.S. The G7 leaders said in their communique that they regret Iran has not yet seized the opportunity to conclude a deal on reviving the JCPOA. The communique said G7 will work to address the threat posed to international security by what it called Iran's nuclear escalation. The G7 leaders also condemned Iran's, quote, destabilizing activities in the region. Iran's permanent representative to the United Nations says certain states are abusing their powers in the Security Council as a means to pursue their, quote, short-sighted political agenda. Majid Tahtaravanchi said such actions both violate the UN Charter and shows disrespect to the Council's authority and powers, jeopardizing its integrity and efficiency. The Iranian diplomat called on the world body to assess the effectiveness of sanctions and their humanitarian consequences at various stages of the conflict and suspend or lift them as needed. He says sanctions have grave humanitarian repercussions as the world witnessed during the COVID-19 pandemic. Afghanistan is still reeling from last week's devastating earthquake that killed over 1,000 people. Survivors are struggling to cope with various problems, from shortages of food and clean water to disease outbreaks. Rahmatullah Baghban reports.
Afghan people affected by the earthquake in southeastern Afghanistan are grappling with dire situations. Hundreds of families are living in the open, out of fear that there may be further tremors.
For the sake of God, please help us survive this catastrophe. The earthquake has devastated our houses and livelihoods. We live outdoors. During the night, it rains very heavily. I'm afraid these harsh conditions will further harm my only surviving family members. In addition, we don't have enough food and cash.
In the meantime, the affected people in Paktika and Khost provinces say that the provided aid is not sufficient.
We thank the Afghan Afghan government and charities for assisting us with humanitarian aid, but they are not sufficient as thousands of our people in several districts have been affected by the deadly earthquake. There are a lot of children who are awaiting food and wounded people who are in dire need of medication. We ask them to scale up their assistance to our people, especially food, drinking water, and tents.
The Afghan health minister, in a press conference in Kabul on Monday, warned that the survivors of the earthquake are at risk of diseases, including mental problems.
This is very true, that affected people are also exposed to getting sick. Some are getting mental or psychological illnesses because they have lost everything, including their loved ones. Some people, especially children, are at risk of malnourishment and other diseases. I call on the international community to help us stave off the disaster and create a safe situation for them to live on.
So far, the United Nations and several neighboring countries have rushed aid to the devastated areas, but helping thousands of victims remains a challenge for the foreign countries due to the U.S. restrictions imposed on the country following the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan. Afghanistan has been facing multiple humanitarian crises in the past decades. The recent earthquake is a reminder that the war-torn country should not be forgotten by the global community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
An official Iranian delegation representing Iran's media sector has concluded a visit to Syria. The delegation held talks with top Syrian officials to boost cooperation in cultural and media domains. Our correspondent in Damascus, Mohammed Ali, has the details.
At the conclusion of an official visit to Syria, an Iranian media delegation headed by Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting chief Payman Jibili met with Syria's Minister of Culture. Jibili congratulated Syria for its victory on terror, asserting terrorism failed to destroy Syria's thousands of years old culture and civilization. He expressed readiness to launch joint projects with Syria in the media and cinema fields.
We discussed topics of mutual interest, such as producing joint movies and cultural documentaries. We also agreed to support joint cultural activities in both countries, like festivals. We hope such visits constitute a starting point for cultural exchange between the two brotherly peoples, because the will of leaderships of both states is to reach the highest level of cooperation.
Syrian Minister of Culture Lubana Mshawah said the war on Syria was aimed at extinguishing its national will and identity, but failed. She expressed Syria's willingness to set up work mechanisms for activating an exchange of expertise between both countries, as well as promoting Syria's culture in Iran and vice versa.
We discussed all details of our cultural cooperation, which would increase to match the level of our political relations. We want the two countries' people to know each other better, and culture is the perfect gateway for that. We ask Iran to play a role in training Syrian cadres in the cinema industry, and we hope to see soon Iranian artists performing at Al-Asad House for art and culture.
The delegation wrapped up the two-day visit, which included meetings with Syria's Prime Minister and Minister of Information. Stress was laid basically on increasing collaboration and joint action to create a stronger frontline against media campaigns that want to mislead the public opinion on the truth of events in the region. Discussions focused on building up stronger relations in various sectors. Officials agreed to step up cooperation between Syrian and Iranian media outlets in an effort to counter Western propaganda against countries that support resistance. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
A new survey conducted by a Muslim group in Britain has revealed just how widespread Islamophobic hate crimes are against Islamic institutions. And the situation is now so bad that many fear an anti-Muslim terrorist attack could be on the horizon. Robert Carter reports.
Islamophobic abuse is something most Muslims living in Britain have to deal with. But many were shocked to discover just how dangerous the problem has become. After shocking statistics have been revealed, which show a large number of British mosques have become regular targets of hate crime. According to survey data gathered by the Muslim Engagement and Development Group, also known as MEND, and in cooperation with Muslim Census, 42% of mosques and Islamic institutions have faced attacks in the past 3 years, and 35% experienced a religiously motivated attack at least once a year, with racial and religious aggravated offences increasing 15% since last year. In a statement, the government reaffirmed its earlier pledge to provide greater funding for mosque security.
We take a zero-tolerance approach to all forms of hate crime, and we're committed to rooting it out wherever it exists. In addition to funding for projects and organizations which promote diversity and tolerance, we're taking steps to safeguard places of worship with a grant of over £24.5 million available this year.
But a spokesperson from Muslim Census claimed that the government isn't doing enough to tackle the issue.
The Home Office publishes a report every year on the distribution of religious hate crimes, and almost half are experienced by Muslims in this country. Now we've got places of worship included as well. Almost half of the mosques experience some form of religious attack as well. And it is a cause for concern. It is super alarming. And as a Muslim, you think, when will I experience something similar?
The most common form of attack is vandalism followed by theft. However, many Islamic institutions have expressed deep fear that future attackers may resort to targeting innocent people as opposed to just property, as was the case outside Finsbury Park Mosque behind me during a deadly terrorist attack targeting the establishment in 2017. Robert Carter, London.
In Ecuador, the government says it will no longer negotiate with indigenous leaders to end nationwide protests against high living costs. President Guillermo Lasso accused the protesters of self-serving politics. He said the government will not negotiate with those who hold Ecuador hostage. For over 2 weeks, indigenous demonstrators have been protesting against high fuel and food prices. 8 people have died in connection with the events. The government tried to quell the demonstrations by offering concessions, including a gasoline price cut, but the demonstrators say that is not enough. Blockades associated with the protests have led to shortages of food and medical supplies. Also, the country's oil production has fallen by 1.8 million barrels during 15 days of protests and blockade. After weeks of talks, Turkey has finally caved and removed an obstacle in the way of Finland and Sweden's membership in NATO.
And I'm pleased to announce that we now have an agreement that paves the way for Finland and Sweden to join NATO. Turkey, Finland and Sweden have signed a memorandum that addresses Turkey's concerns, including around arms exports and the fight against terrorism.
President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's office said in a statement Ankara got what it wanted from Finland and Sweden. It explained the two Nordic states agreed to cooperate fully with Turkey in its fight against the PKK militants. This, as a senior U.S. official said, no concessions have been given to Ankara. Finland and Sweden submitted their requests to join NATO in May in the wake of Russia's military operation in Ukraine. Turkey at the same time rejected their bids, accusing them of supporting the Kurdish PKK militant group, which Ankara deems a terrorist organization. France's election season has come to an end with the seating of its new parliament. Many wonder if a deeply divided legislature, which will get along with President Emmanuel Macron, who could call for new elections if they don't act according to his liking. Ramin Mazahedi reports from Paris.
France's new parliament has been inaugurated, and many expect the next 5 years will be turbulent. President Emmanuel Macron was reprimanded at the ballot box, losing his absolute majority. He then failed to cobble together a coalition, leaving France with a so-called hung parliament. Each different bill will now have to find its own majority to become enacted, although since 2012, French presidents have often resorted to executive decrees to pass unpopular, austerity-minded legislation. Many also speculate that if Parliament doesn't work in his favor, that Macron could call for new elections in maybe a matter of months.
He's not going to be able to do anything to make any reform because it's going to be completely blocked between the extreme right wing and the Mélenchon team, which are completely opposite. And so I believe that not much is going to happen during the next 5 years, which will give rise to, you know, more extreme positions in the future.
The far-right national rally, led by Marine Le Pen, won a record 15% of seats. Islamophobia has already been obvious in France's judicial and presidential branches, and now it's widely present in their legislative branch.
We now have an assembly which better represents the range of public opinion. The president will stay in his assigned role of a sort of republican monarch. We'll see more debate, and that might produce more reforms.
A clear improvement is an increased number of working-class legislators, thanks to the NUPES leftist coalition, but even more so because of the national rally. Still, just 6% of parliamentarians are from the working class. Yael Braun-Pivet was elected speaker, the first woman to hold the post, and another relatively unknown politician from Macron's party. France is the second-to-last country in the European Union to have a woman head a House of Parliament. By denying Macron a majority, French Parliament is poised to play a bigger role than at any time in the 21st century. However, they face an executive branch which has repeatedly found ways to either sideline or bypass them. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Russia says it will stop its offensive in Ukraine as soon as Ukrainian forces lay down their arms.
The Ukrainian side can end all this before the end of this day. An order is necessary for the nationalist units to lay down their weapons. An order is necessary for the Ukrainian military to lay down their weapons. And they must fulfill all Russia's demands. Then everything will be over before the day ends.
A Kremlin spokesman said Russia's special military operation in Ukraine is ongoing, according to plan to achieve the stated goals. Peskov made the comments after Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called on G7 leaders to help end the war with Russia by the end of this year. On Tuesday, the G7 leaders ended their three-day summit in Germany. They reiterated support for Ukraine and agreed to toughen sanctions on Russia to pressure it into ending the war. Moscow, however, has blamed the West for prolonging the conflict. And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
For the betterment of Nigeria and preservation of its unity in diversity, the authorities, whether the present ones or those to come after the presidential elections, should discharge their duties sincerely in bringing an end to the nefarious activities of the various groups of bandits, kidnappers, terrorists, shadowy gunmen, rustlers and others, especially those taking orders from Riyadh, Tel Aviv and Washington to backstab their own country and fellow citizens. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan, international staff writer. This article is published under the heading Nigerian Shia Muslims Focus on National Unity. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. It is often said that Nigeria, Africa's most populated country, which is made up of 250 ethnic groups speaking 500 distinct languages and all identifying with a wide variety of cultures, is difficult to govern. Presidential elections are to be held every next year, and with incumbent Muhammadu Buhari unlikely to be re-elected because of his advanced age, coupled with mismanagement of the past 2 4-year terms, several candidates from different parties are vying for the chief executive's post. The country of 216 million people, of whom some 60% are Muslims, the rest being Christians and animists, is rich in oil and gas resources. The boast of being Africa's largest economy, but widespread corruption has prevented Nigeria from eradicating poverty and backwardness in order to join the community of developing states. This has led to runaway inflation and rampant terrorism, spearheaded by the Boko Haram Takfiri outfit, and of course, open violation of democratic principles, as was evident by the personal vendetta of President Buhari in taking orders from Saudi Arabia and the fake regime of Israel to persecute the rapidly growing community of Shia Muslims and imprison on spurious charges the prominent leader, Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, who leads the Islamic Movement of Nigeria, IMN, was released from prison last month after 6 years of imprisonment along with his wife, despite the long-pending verdict of the federal court for his freedom, bears no grudges against his prosecutors. He calls for respect for the birthrights of the 14 million Shia Muslim citizens as guaranteed by the National Constitution, solidarity among all Nigerians, irrespective of their religious and ethnic affinities, and serious measures against corruption and terrorism, so as to build a strong and stable welfare state. Recently, Sheikh Zakzaki deplored the sorry state of affairs prevailing under the highly discriminatory rule of Buhari, saying, "The enemies of religion expect the only way to succeed is to carry a gun and shoot only." These sentiments are echoed by other prominent Nigerian figures of both the Christians and Muslims, including the traditional Sufi orders, who resent the distortion of Islamic values by Saudi-sponsored Wahhabi groups, whose only aim is to spread sedition among Muslims and hatred towards the followers of other religious groups through the unbridled acts of terrorism by Boko Haram and similar factions that have infiltrated the administrative system. In this regard, the Imam Mahdi Foundation, a Shia Muslim organization promoting peace and understanding, has called on Nigerians to reconsider the need for peace, unity, and understanding to pave the way for development and progress in Nigeria. Muhammad Ibrahim Gamawa, the chairman of the Imam Mahdi Foundation, said in his recent statement that, as a multicultural, multi-religious, and multilingual union, Nigeria is blessed in its diversity. He added, It is our duty as Nigerians to exploit this God-given opportunity for the betterment of our nation and posterity. Once again, we are going through a season of politics to decide who will lead our country. It is time for Nigerians to look inwards and vote for leaders who can make the country a better place, irrespective of tribe, religion, or region. Wise words indeed. This is ample proof of the fact that Nigerian Shia Muslims are dedicated to the peace, progress, and stability of their homeland. Therefore, for the betterment of Nigeria and preservation of its unity in diversity, the authorities, whether the present ones or those to come after the presidential elections, should discharge their duties sincerely in bringing an end to nefarious activities of the various groups of bandits, kidnappers, terrorists, shadowy gunmen, rustlers and others, especially those taking orders from Riyadh, Tel Aviv and Washington to backstab their own country and fellow citizens.
Food for thought.
Salam, dear friends, and we start the day with a statement from the Prophet's ninth infallible heir, Imam Muhammad Taqi, peace upon him, who provides us a glimpse of the rights of women in Islam, whose laws and liberties are far superior to whatever the modern world can conceive. The Prophet, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, accepted the pledge of allegiance of women by dipping his hand in a bowl of water. And when he took his hand out, the women dipped their hands in that bowl and declared the Shahada, that is, faith in God, belief in the Prophet's mission, and the matters they had to acknowledge.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you. This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's topic, the abandoned treasures. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We are an ummah, we are a nation whose first revelation and inspiration was Iqra, read. We are people of a culture which was built upon the slogan of Allama bil Qalam. With the pen, he taught. We are followers of a great prophet who taught us Ista'in bi yaminik, seek help from your hands to write. So when people used to come to Holy Prophet and tell him that many of the teachings which you tell us, we forget those precious information. The Holy Prophet said, Ista'in bi yaminik, seek help from your hand, write down. So we read and then we wrote. And we then read and wrote until we discovered an abandoned treasure, a book. And then we wrote another, and third, and fourth, until we needed a library. Then one, another, and third. So we eventually established a civilization based upon reading, writing, and books. That was our great civilization of Islam. In that civilization, the books are said to be, as Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam says, Al-Kutubu Basatinul Ulama. The books are the orchards of scholars. And what does that mean? That they grow trees of knowledge there and pluck the fruits of wisdom. So we are children of a culture which began with Iqra, read, and flourished with Allama bil Qalam, with the pen he taught. Such a great civilization and such a great culture and such a great nation, which was based upon the knowledge and books. That was our culture. That was our real legacy. Welcome back. We were talking about our beautiful legacy of knowledge, our beautiful legacy and culture of reading, writing, and books. Well, if we have such a rich culture and such a great culture and rich history of relationship to books, if we are the successors of a wonderful tradition of reading and writing, if we are heirs of a great legacy of books and writings in all fields of knowledge, then why we fell behind? Why we distanced ourselves from their tradition? Why we should be detached from the wonderful legacy of reading and writing? We should think and reconsider our individual and collective life and return to that great tradition, not only because that books cause nations to develop and prosper, but also because books are themselves great. They are lovely. They make a good and loyal friend. They enlighten you from inside and open new horizons for you in the life. They are sources of self-development and reform. You reveal new things about yourself, about people around you. They are doors which you open towards new worlds, new realms. So at the last, I will say, stick to the books. Befriend them. Rather fall in love with them. They will never betray you. Also teach your children to befriend them. Choose good books for them. That will eventually make them good humans. Because books are flowers. They have fragrance. And their fragrance is knowledge. Their fragrance is virtue. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala help us to choose good books and read them and enlighten ourselves by the fragrance of the books. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news, with delight.
Just like humans and animals, plants get sick too. But what do you do with an ill plant? An Indian man has found an answer to that. He has opened an emergency room only for plants in Amritsar, a city in India's Punjab state. A tax officer and his wife have set up the Pushpa Tree and Plant Hospital. In Pushpa, they have expert biologists and tree lovers on hand to provide the so-called sick patients with their essential nutrients. The clinic aims to treat any and every disease and even has an emergency vehicle on call for unhealthy trees around the city. The officer's wife says, just as we humans bleed, breathe and need cures, plants also bleed, breathe and need cures.
We provide approximately 32 various services for plants and trees, like if there's a nail in the tree, how to take out that nail. Deep poisoning of the trees. Yes, you heard it right. There are people who poison the trees. Again, if the tree is not bearing fruits, there's an attack of mealybugs or another insects. That's also cured here. If the trees or plants are dying and you're unable to take care of them, even that problem is sorted out.
Only a month into the hospital's operation, Rohit Mehra and his team of 20 volunteers have already received more than 300 queries. The hospital is also completely free of charge. Staff at the National Zoo of Cuba in the capital city of Havana are celebrating a new arrival of a rare baby white rhinoceros. The little calf, named Al, quickly became popular among other animals in the park after he was born. He is part of a conservation program that will add to a gene bank for future breeding. Al is the second white rhinoceros to be born in captivity in 18 years. The park is home to 8 white rhinos and 4 black ones. Zoo staff say the park has one of the largest exhibits of this mammal among zoos in Latin America. White rhinos are endangered species and their population has dwindled due to illegal poaching and environmental destruction.
Persian fallow deer is a unique but endangered species known for its sleek and spotted body. In this report, our correspondent Youssef Jalali takes us on a quick tour around one of the world's few protected shelters of Persian fallow deer in Iran's city of Sari.
We had to keep quiet and avoid making any sounds to film them, as they are shy and swift, and the slightest sound could send them sprinting and jumping away. Over 60 Persian fallow deer roam in Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Iran's northern city of Sari. The endangered species is carefully protected here to be safe from predators and poachers.
The Persian fallow deer is native to Iran's Khuzestan province.
but due to loss of habitat and threats posed to them by predators such as jackals and wild cats, they are endangered and need to be protected in semi-natural refuges like this one.
Persian fallow deer are mainly indigenous to open woodland areas spanning from East Mediterranean coasts to West and Southwest Iran. By 1875, they had gone extinct in all of their main habitats, except in southwest Iran. After a captive breeding program, the population has rebounded from only a handful of deer in the 1960s to over 200 individuals in Iran.
Dashtinoz Wildlife Refuge is a 55 hectares wide. It was introduced in 1962 as a shelter for the Persian fallow deer when the species was on the brink of extinction. At that time, five deer were captured and translocated to this refuge. Over the past six decades, their number have been multiplied through captive breeding.
The Persian fallow deer is a rare ruminant mammal belonging to the family Cervidae. They're physically larger than other fallow deer, and their antlers are bigger and less palmate. Their special beauty has turned this sanctuary into a hot tourist attraction in Iran's north.
This sanctuary is a tourist destination for visitors who would like to see the Hyrkanian forests in Iran's north and at the same time enjoy the wildlife and learn about efforts made to save the Persian fallow deer from extinction.
In 2015, the Persian fallow deer was registered in the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. Dashtinoz authorities hope through continued captive breeding, the population of these special creatures will soon reach the desired number, and hopefully they will be reintroduced to their natural habitat in southwest Iran.
While they live far from their original habitat, these alluring creatures feel at home here, where they will be safe from the dangers lurking outside, which may lead to their extinction. So here, Persian fallow deer continue to embellish the nature and charm visitors with their beauty. Yusuf Jalali from Dashtinoz Wildlife Refuge in Sari.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Catching fish makes you forget even the most complex problems. But think the moment you catch the strangest one. Well, a Cambodian fisherman has caught what researchers say is the world's biggest freshwater fish ever recorded. The giant fish, which weighs around 300 kilograms and 4 meters long, was caught last week from the Mekong River. The female stingray was released back into water after being electronically tagged to allow scientists to monitor her movement and behavior. The fish was named a Barami, meaning full moon in the Khmer language. An American fish biologist, Dana Lee, says the data collected from Barami can help protect the species and its habitat.
We got a call this morning at breakfast that they had caught a giant stingray here at Coprea. So we dropped everything. People came up from Phnom Penh, and we're here now just at sunset, just tagged the giant, 330-kilogram giant stingray here in the Mekong River, and released it here right at sunset.
The stingray dethrones the former record holder, a 290-kilogram catfish found in northern Thailand in 2005. More than 1,000 species live in the Mekong River. The famous waterway originates in China and twists south through parts of Thailand, Laos, Myanmar, Cambodia, and Vietnam. Scientists have warned that plastic waste and dam threaten wildlife even in the deepest stretches of the Mekong. Geologists are rejoicing over a new discovery. A 290-million-old fossil forest has accidentally been found in southern Brazil. A team of geologists had been sent to the state of Paraná to investigate the rocks there. To their surprise, they were able to find over 160 logs of lycophytes, an extinct variety of the vascular plant subgroup. It's quite rare occurrence that a large number of fossils of the plant were found preserved in upright position for such a long time. The forest itself was discovered in 2018 when a street was being constructed over there. So far, only two other similar collections have been found in smaller forest areas of Brazil and Argentina. June 21st marks the International Day of Yoga. On this day, people, especially Hindus around the world, gather in open spaces to perform this ancient physical exercise, raising awareness of its benefits on the human body and mind. Yoga is believed to have originated in India thousands of years ago and is mentioned in ancient Hindu mythological books. The word yoga derives from Sanskrit and means to join or unite, symbolizing the union of body and consciousness. In India, the day is celebrated with a different theme each year, with this year's theme being Yoga for Humanity. Mass yoga events took place around India, especially in and around iconic sites such as the Taj Mahal. Other countries, such as Vietnam and Thailand, also celebrated Yoga Day with hundreds performing it in open spaces.
Agriculture is no exception when it comes to adapting new technologies in the context of changing climate. Now, French farmers in the northwestern suburbs of Paris grow greens in any season using hydroponic farms. Residents of a housing estate have ditched the traditional way of farming to create jobs for their community. Hydroponic farming is a method of growing plants in water, not in soil. It may sound like it would be a complicated process, but it's actually quite straightforward. The system is made of plastic and uses a rich organic ecosystem. The workers use less water than usual and do not even need a teaspoon of soil. One of the employees describes how they turned barren land into a farm.
It used to be a garage where they stored cars, but since there were no more cars, we used it as a dormitory. We listened to music and watched football matches. We used to meet here to have a bit of privacy and breathe, to hide away for a while. But now that it's become a place of work, I'm happy because I'm working.
Hydroponic farms can be used to grow products of all kinds in any region. In this one, farmers are planting all sorts of things, ranging from Peruvian mint to Vietnamese coriander. They hope that the system can be used to help local residents, especially those who need it the most.
People in Poland have rolled out flower carpets for the feast of Corpus Christi held in the central village of Spiszemierz. Families usually arrange colorful and symbolic carpets for the procession on the road section in front of their homes. They use flowers picked from the surrounding fields or their own gardens. They also use soil, sand and fresh cut grass. The procession begins from the church and roams the streets of the village. The flower carpets have been rolled out annually since the tradition started 200 years ago, except for once when a storm broke out.
This tradition is 200 years old, and according to what the village elders say, it has only happened once that there was no carpet of flowers for the procession, because a storm broke out and swept everything away in the afternoon.
Families begin collecting the flowers a few days before the feast and arrange it on the celebration day. Besides its religious aspect, the event is also meant to express appreciation for nature. The practice has been passed from generation to generation ever since it began. The tradition was registered at UNESCO's Cultural Heritage List last year.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Through its agencies, the U.S. government regularly plants fake news and false information. Therefore, social media hiring individuals straight from the FBI, CIA, NATO, and other groups to work on regulating disinformation is a fundamentally flawed practice. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Alan McLeod, journalist. This article is published under the heading, The Federal Bureau of Tweets. Twitter is hiring an alarming number of FBI agents. Stay tuned, please, for the second part of this article. Some might ask, what is the problem with Twitter actively recruiting from the FBI, CIA, and other three-letter agencies? They, after all, are experts in studying online disinformation and propaganda. What is optical? If a Russian-owned social media apps trust, security and content moderation was run by former KGB or FSB agents and still insisted it was a politically neutral platform, the entire world would laugh. But apart from this, the huge influx of security state personnel into Twitter's decision-making ranks means that the company will start to view every problem in the same manner as the U.S. government does and act accordingly. In terms of their outlooks on the world and on the question of misinformation and internet security, you couldn't get a better field of professionals who are almost inherently going to be more in tune with the government's perspective Thus, when policing the platform for disinformation and influence campaigns, the former FBI and CIA agents and Atlantic Council fellows only ever seem to find them emanating from enemy states and never from the U.S. regime itself. Twitter has mirrored U.S. hostility towards states like Russia, China, and Cuba, attempting to suppress the reach and influence of their state media by adding warning messages to the tweets of journalists and accounts affiliated with those governments. In a rather bizarre adamant, it explained that it would not be doing the same to state-affiliated media or personalities from other countries, least of all the U.S. state-financed media organizations with editorial independence, like NPR, for example, are not defined as a state-affiliated media for the purposes of this policy, it wrote. Perhaps most notable, however, was Twitter's announcement last year that it was deleting dozens of accounts for the new violation of undermining faith in the NATO alliance. The statement was widely ridiculed online by users, but few noted that the decision was based upon a partnership with the Stanford Internet Observatory, a counter-disinformation think tank filled with former spooks and state officials and headed by an individual who is on the advisory board of NATO's Collective Cybersecurity Center of Excellence. That Twitter is working so closely with organizations that are clearly intelligence industry catspaws should concern all users. While some might be alarmed that Twitter is cultivating such an intimate relationship with the FBI and other groups belonging to the secret state, it is perhaps unfair to single it out, as many social media platforms are doing the same. Facebook, for example, has entered into formal partnership with the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensics Research Lab, whereby the latter holds significant influence over 2.9 billion users' news feeds, helping to decide what content to promote and what content to suppress. The NATO cutout organization now serves as Facebook's eyes and ears, according to a Facebook press release. Anti-war and anti-establishment voices across the world have reported massive drops in traffic on the platform. The social media giant also hired former NATO press secretary Ben Nemo to be its head of intelligence. Nemo subsequently used his power to attempt to swing the election in Nicaragua away from the leftist Sandinista party and towards the far-right pro-US candidate, deleting hundreds of left-wing voices in the week of the election, claiming they were engaging in inauthentic behavior. When these individuals, including some well-known personalities, poured onto Twitter, recording video messages proving they were not bots, Twitter deleted those accounts too, in what one commentator called a Silicon Valley double tap strike. An April Mint Press study revealed how TikTok too has been filling its organization with alumni of the Atlantic Council, NATO, the CIA, and the State Department. As with Twitter, these new TikTok employees largely work in highly politically sensitive fields such as trust, safety, security, and content moderation, meaning these state operatives hold influence over the direction of the company and what content.